This is another iRaw podcast.
If you're forcing a dog to breed when she doesn't want it, or the male doesn't want it, or if it's a little traumatic, not ethical. If you have to crop, dock, cut any part of your dog, not ethical. If you have to do C-section for your dog, not ethical. And I don't know how many of you listeners know that, but bulldogs, these breeds, the flat-faced breed, the brachy dogs, most of them, over 90% of them usually, need to have C-section. These dogs are not naturally constructed and fit to actually have puppies.
My name is Katya, and this is The Animal That Changed You. I believe loving an animal is one of the most accessible, most available portals for self-healing in the whole world. It's my privilege to encourage you to open your heart to animals and challenge you to deepen your compassion just a little bit more. Welcome to The Animal That Changed You.
Hi, friendas and friendos. Welcome back to the Animal That Changed You podcast. You guys know it's been a time. Well, my girl's gone. And I'm sitting with that reality. If you were able to hear last week's episode, I'm sure you've heard a lot more than you wanted to know about my family, my marriage, and Ophelia. But she is very special. You know, I was asking the universe, goddess above, like, to give me a sign. I'm like, give me a sign that she's okay. I just need to know that she's okay. And the other day, I realized I'd had this song in my mind, random song in my mind for like 2 days. And I was like, why is this song in my head? Like, why? And then I played it and I started sobbing because the song was Amarillo by Morning, which is a George Strait song from like the 1990s. Like, why would Amarillo by Morning, a George Strait song from the 1990s, be in my head? Why? There's no good answer. Then I heard it. I played it really loud by myself and, of course, started sobbing and was like, that's a message from Ophelia that she's okay. And I really think that that's true. So maybe I'm wanting to believe that. But do me a favor. Later on today, or right after you hear this episode, with no other than Sophie Gamond, who's a wonderful guest. You know her work. You've seen her pictures of pit bulls wearing flower crowns. She's our guest today, you guys. We're really lucky. And I'm excited she's here and I'm going to get to it. But if you have a second, listen to Amarillo by Morning. Tell me if that is not Ophelia. Tell me if that doesn't sound like the right song to hear from somebody on the other side. And I'm not saying Amarillo's heaven. I don't think I could make that proclamation. I also don't know Amarillo, so no offense to anyone from there, but I love her and I miss her. And I'm going to dedicate this episode and probably all of them for the end of time to Ophelia. Hey, if you get a chance, leave us a review. If you get a chance, let me know what you think of Amarillo by Morning. If you get a chance, DM, tell me how you're doing. How's the animal that changed you? How are you feeling? What do you need? What are you thinking about animals these days? I'd love to connect with all of you, and I'm sending big hugs. Let's go talk to Sophie.
Sophie Gamond.
Hi.
I'm so happy you're here. You are an animal advocate. You are an artist. You are an award-winning photographer. You do all these incredibly gorgeous, stunning, powerful, meaningful, emotional photographs of not only shelter dogs, but at-risk dogs and animals at large, and also in relation to their humans, showing our humanity. And you do it pro bono. You do it for nonprofits, rescues, and shelters. You do it because you communicate through art, as you say. I am a fan of your Wet Dog series. I am a fan of your Pitbull Flower Power series. You've earned every fan. And I'm really happy you're here. You were one of the first people who articulated for me this idea of dogs having agency. And I was so grateful to connect with you so that someone out there, out of my head, could say it the way I believed it. Talk to us about your photography, Dogs with Agency, The Animals That Changed You. We're here for all of it in your French accent.
Oh boy. How many hours do we have?
Ready, go.
I love talking about this stuff and conversing around this subject. Briefly via email, we chatted a little bit about my views on dogs and how they are at our mercy and how they don't have a lot of agency. But then last night I had a new thought come in to my brain and I woke up and I was like, oh, you know, I don't know if we need to feel sorry for dogs because in a way, they're kind of genius. They're so symbiotic. That's how they evolve. That's how they survive. That's how they thrive. Now I look at my dog and I'm like, do I feel sorry for you because you're held captive? Or do I think, wow, you're genius. You literally make me do everything for you. You know? So I'm kind of like in between right now, these two concepts.
You're like, I feel sorry for you and also sorry for me.
Who's the slave here?
You know, we had another guest on the show recently who said something like, people worry about if the dog's outside. We should be outside more. We need to go outside.
Yes.
Like, and I was like, oh, wow. I love those like contradictory thoughts.
Sometimes you have to take an idea and shift it around, put it upside down and see how you feel about it. You know, and that's how you grow and that's how you kind of expand your horizon and your perception of things. And there's a lot of interesting thoughts about free roaming, free ranging dogs. Free roaming, I guess, is the most common terminology. So these are dogs who don't live in homes. They can be stray dogs, street dogs. They can be village dogs. They can be also dogs who live on the farm but never come inside the house, but kind of like on their own. And it's a very controversial subject for some reason. Like I recently got savaged on social media for alluding to the idea that maybe some of these dogs do totally fine without us. And some people were very upset with me and said, well, I invite you to go see street dogs in Mexico or, you know, and see how much they suffer, the diseases they have and the illnesses, injuries, and how they're starving. And yeah, it's very complicated thoughts.
It is very complicated, but in our country, we just put it behind doors. We put it in a cage. And I don't know if that makes it, it's different, but it's not necessarily better. You know, a shelter is not, it's not like a world of improvement. It's unnatural.
When I'm in my studio, I feel like I keep pushing boxes around because it's not organized in a way that is conducive of me doing the work. And so when I'm like, oh, I should do some studio work today, I enter the studio and I take a box and I move it around and I try to reorganize and make more room. And I feel like that's the shelter system a little bit, or the system that we've set up, because we have so many dogs who are seemingly unwanted or people can't keep them anymore. Not just dogs. I'm going to say dogs during this episode, but I'm talking, of course, about all the animals.
Sure.
It's just the first word that comes to mind.
Me too.
But we basically shuffle them around, you know, and one of a very difficult thought that I had a few years back was when I would see at the city shelter when I lived in New York City, a lot of rescues would pull dogs. Some of these rescues would put the dog in boarding and continue pulling more dogs from the city shelter, right? To save them from euthanasia.
Yeah.
But then there would be these dogs who had been sitting in a wire cage for 8 years in a boarding facility somewhere who wouldn't even get walked every day. It's a minority, of course. Like I'm talking about the dark corners of rescue here, not the mainstream rescue. But there's a lot of shuffling happening like this in the rescue system.
Yes, which is why your point about stray dogs, even if it is just the minority, there are animals that are, I mean, in Cuba, where my parents are from, they had a name, and I'm going to get it wrong, but they had a name for, the name for leftovers. Sobremesa is when you sit around the table.
Right.
I think it was sobremesa. They had a term that my dad's side of the family would call all stray dogs because it meant to like throw, it to their family, it meant like to throw the scraps.
Right.
They called all the dogs that name. My dad and his brother and sister grew up throwing scraps at stray dogs. Like, oh, here you go. Here you go. Here's sobremesa. Here's sobremesa. My point being, maybe there are a lot who suffer, but to what you said on social media, there are some who are,
there's
might
a
be
percentage.
Okay.
I think are okay, have very successful lives. Obviously, they're more prone to parasites and things like this, especially when they live close to humans. Like, so, you know, I discovered the world of rescue in Puerto Rico. That's where I kind of learned all the ropes, you know.
What were you doing there?
I had just started becoming obsessed with taking photos of dogs. I met a rescuer. I offered to take photos of the dogs who were up for adoption. I was actually trying to volunteer. Believe it or not, shelters would just like not even answer me or close the door, say, oh, no, you know, we don't know who you are. We don't like, it took me a couple of years to actually, or maybe a little less, but it felt like a long time to actually find a shelter that would say, oh, sure. What's your name? Sophie? Yeah, sure. Come take photos of our adoptable. Back then, this was, you know, over 10 years ago, it wasn't something that was done a lot. So I found this rescuer who said, oh my God, yes, I would love for you to take photos of my dogs and help me place them. And I was like, oh my God, yes, awesome, finally somebody says yes, you know. And I started volunteering. I ended up becoming kind of her right arm, you know, like doing a lot of trips on the island in Puerto Rico, pulling dogs off the streets, you know, and witnessing the vetting process and the entire process. So I learned a lot. And, you know, in Puerto Rico, so it's a tiny island that has a lot of strays. The estimates back then were 250,000 for an island the size of Connecticut, I think. Like it's
wow.
You know, when you go there, of course, not in the touristic spots, which are being cleaned, you know, and often dogs are actually being poisoned by hotels or, you know, to make sure like there's no stray dogs. But if you go in the rural areas or areas that are a little less touristic, a little less developed, doggies are everywhere roaming free. So in Puerto Rico, you have a lot of different kind of dogs. You have pets who live in homes, you know, walk on a leash. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you have feral dogs who have never been owned by humans, kind of live on the margin, you know, eat from the trash and like will never let you touch them, approach them, barely take food from you. You know, like they just want nothing to do with humans. And then in between, you have dogs who have been dumped in the street. You have dogs who are more like street dogs. So it's dogs who were maybe born to dogs who are more social with humans. Well, their parents were owned by humans, so they have more of a relationship with humans. You have like such a different, like a wide spectrum. I remember seeing some of the feral dogs being rescued, quote unquote. The way I see it is more like captured, right? And forced into a life that they're not necessarily equipped for, they don't necessarily want. And that really taught me a lot. Like it was on my first rescue trip, basically, that I saw it for the first time and I was shocked. I'm like, why are we rescuing this dog who is literally biting us and destroying the crate, trying to escape and go back to the wild? And the rescuer told me, you know, like, I know I can get that dog a better life.
Sophie, so, I have to say, though, I had experience with this, and I'm so happy you're bringing this up. I used to foster for a Taiwanese rescue that would send the animals through an LA rescue, and there were some, you could tell they were a feral dog trying to be forced to be a pet dog. And there was one named Pearl, and I'll never forget her, who she just would run away from every place she went. She did not want it. And it was one day she ran away from the last foster home, and it was brutal.
I'm sorry to hear. I think, you know, there is a conversation to be had within the rescue community on how we can do the work we do in the most responsible way for all involved, humans, but also animals. And I'm sorry, Facebook haters who were very mad at me for saying this. Sometimes a dog belongs to the wild and it's fine. And maybe you can trap, neuter, release, but why
is
not?
It different for cats? Why?
Oh, okay, cats is a whole different story, which I'm not even going to touch. Because
But it is curious. It is curious to me that we accept TNR for cats. I know very little. I've done very little TNR and that's next level. And I'm just not that cool yet. I will say, I think that there's a human bump, a hesitation to remember that we can't control the outcome of all these animals' lives. And I think there's more of a hesitation to accept that with dogs. And I look, I'm speaking in wide generalizations, but I understand that like accepting that a dog on the street might be happy, satisfied, living a fine life leaves room for like, is that dog going to get hit by a car? Are they going to get sick? Are they going to, those unknowns are very hard for us to sit with. We've made this shelter system where we know, but do we know?
And also the shelter system, you know, is big and varied. Within the shelter system, there's a little bit of everything from the boutique shelters who will keep dogs forever if they have to, sanctuaries, to animal control facilities where McLovin, my dog, comes from, for example, in Puerto Rico, which is like literally just a death place where they pick up the strays and they euthanize them. It's just a way to kind of control the population, which is nuts because spay and neuter is obviously the way to control population in a humane way. But in a lot of places, it doesn't happen that way, you know, and you have states that have very few shelter animals and states that have a lot of them, like California or New York, you know, there's a lot of animals in the shelter system.
Where did you grow up in France?
In Lyon.
What is the shelter system like there? Were you an animal lover growing up? And were you aware of all this? Like by the time you went to Puerto Rico and you were obsessed with taking pictures of dogs, were you already an animal lover?
Yes, I was an animal lover, or at least I had like a really deep connections with animals since I was very little. In the shelter system growing up, it was like, you know, you would have one shelter, not even per city. I remember just hearing the story of like, oh, shelter dogs, you know, shelters are very sad. Shelter dogs are old or sick, you know, and it's just not a place, a happy place where you go to find your new friend. So all the dogs that I grew up with in my family were bought from breeders. I know that my grandmother had dogs her entire life, and she died at 91, 92, just before when the pandemic hit. She had dogs that she would just find. She had dogs that sometimes would get puppies, and she would keep puppies, and she would give the puppies away. So I think first, it's a generation thing. Back then, when I was a kid and all that, I think things were different. I also do think that a lot of countries in Europe do not have the same numbers that we have here. Why? Really just don't have as many animals in the shelter system there. I did the calculation once, like per population. I really need to look at those numbers again because I want to bring it up often. And I'm like, what were the numbers again? But it was something like 51 dogs for 50 people in the US, whereas in France, it's one dog for 600 people.
Why do you think
that is? In the shelter system. I think for that, we would need statistics from the shelters, which we really don't have nationwide in the US, to say, where did this animal come from? There's very little data available.
There's no data that we have mass database.
Yeah, somebody should do that. But I don't even know how they would begin, because you have the dogs that are actually in the shelter system. You don't necessarily know their story for real, because people lie, people hide, people are ashamed. There's such a stigma around surrendering an animal that people will say, oh, I found this dog, you know, and then you talk to the kid and they're like, that was my dog, you know. And so you never really, true story, it happened to me in Puerto Rico, which is why I bring it up. You know, this father bringing a dog saying, oh, we found this dog. And I asked the children who were in the back seat, like, do you know this dog? They were like, yeah, it's our dog. And I knew that dog was going to be euthanized. They were leading him to just, being killed for no reason. So we don't have data. We don't have stats. It's very difficult to understand why are animals in the system, what leads them there, and what's the outcome. Also beyond the shelter system, there's the rescue system. So private rescues, nonprofits that operate on the sidelines. And then you also have the non-rescue world, which is basically people giving their dog to a neighbor or people finding a dog in the street and taking. So all that, it creates this crazy web. But to go back to the US, one of my theory about why there's so many shelter pets in the US, well, first, there's the fast culture of like high people just consume, you know, it's easy to get a dog. It's easy to get a pet. You go to the pet store, It's cheap in a lot of places. You know, if you don't go to a breeder, you can get a pit bull puppy for $20 from the back of a trunk of a car on a Walmart parking lot. It's cheap. It's easy to get dogs. And life is a little more precarious in the US. You guys don't have social security the same way we do in Europe. Let's say in France, for example, you know, medical care is virtually free. Education is free. There's a lot of governmental aid for people who are, you know, going through tough times. You can get help for, you know, to pay your gas bills, to pay your rent.
That matters. That matters a great deal. And I'm glad you're bringing it up, because if you can't pay for those basic needs, you can't pay for your animal. And to be judged for that is a grave injustice.
Yeah, actually, you know, there's an article I just flagged. It's on my reading list about how somebody did a study and realized that pets who are owned by homeless people or houseless people
are happy,
just as well taken care of.
Sure.
And I think there's a stigma around that too. You know, we think, okay, to own an animal, you have to check all those boxes. Okay, this conversation is going in a lot of different directions.
I know. Try and keep it simple. I know. You and I are the wild, wild west together. I can't help it.
This brings up also the question of like, how hard should the adoption process be? But that's a whole different conversation, because we make people jump through hoops. But really, should it be that hard to have a pet? Should having a pet only be reserved for people who can afford it? So rich people, middle class, upper middle class, like where do you draw the line?
Right. So then pets become a way to show status. Which brings us back to that pit bull in a shelter isn't for me, right? Because that doesn't reflect to the world what I want them to think of me. It misses the entire point of the magic of having a pet, in my opinion. Now, I'm not saying that you're not allowed to love breeds or want your whatever kind of dog, go for it. I'm not here to judge the love that somebody feels for their dog versus, you know, depending on where they got it is not different versus another person's. Like, I can't judge that. I am saying that I think what you're talking about brings up this big Pandora's box of using animals to reflect our status or to raise our status, not intentionally, not consciously, then therefore all these shelter animals are just off the table. They're somebody else's problem, but they're our problem because we're paying the tax dollars for them to be warehoused and euthanized.
I mean, yes, and it's very expensive.
Yes. And then people miss the gift of having a pet, which is all about the relationship and the personality and zero to do with the color of their fur or how much they were.
One thing about breeds that I wonder is it seems to be reassuring to people to know how their dog is going to look like and to kind of identify with the visual, okay, right? So
that's fair.
It's like, oh, I want a dog that reminds me of my childhood pet, which was a golden retriever. Not my favorite dogs. You know, I want that. I don't understand. I'm a multi-mutt type of girl. Like me the too. More mixes, the more you know, take me off the streets and you look like this unicorn dog because it looks like God wanted to make a chihuahua, but then he changed his mind halfway. And then, you know, like that's my kind of dog personally. So I think there is this, you know, we've been groomed to think a dog needs to look a certain way. And that certain way is usually used to be a golden retriever or a Labrador. Nowadays, it's a Labradoodle, which is even worse. No offense to the Labradoodle owners out there. We love you. We love your doggy.
We do love you. And we love how you love your dog. Even though the person who invented the Labradoodle says he regrets it.
Yeah, he regrets it. So I think there's something for some reason reassuring for people to get a breed that they know, oh, I understand what this is. It's a pug. Yes. It's a Frenchie, whatever. I don't know if social status comes into play. I think it's more like identifying with the group. So if you have a Frenchie, you know, maybe you're a gay man living in West Hollywood, you know, and your Frenchie is Brindle with blue eyes. The Merle Frenchies are my nemesis. I hate them with a passion. Well, not them, because they're doggies.
No.
I love them.
Oh, no, I get it.
I hate the concept dog, of it.
You're right.
Yeah.
For the dog, you would do anything, but...
Yeah, I mean, Frenchies probably are becoming the number one breed in the US during the pandemic. The Frenchie revolution started. I mean, it's insane. I don't understand why you would want a cookie cutter dog that looks like your neighbor's dog, personally. I once met a girl that ran a store in a small town, and she was so excited to tell me that there were like 15 dogs related to her dog living in the town because she kept sending people to her breeder. I can see why you think it's cute, but it's also kind of gross.
Also, did she look at your Instagram page? Did she know what you do?
Oh, well, we had words. We had some words. Not my proudest mama. My husband always drags me away like, shh, calm down. Let's go.
Mine too.
He's always good, but like sometimes it's just like, you know, yeah. So she talked to the wrong girl. She was so excited about her. Her dog that she had was basically kind of like the nephew or whatever of the dog that had just died or something like that. And she thought it was so cute. And I'm like, it's kind of so disrespectful to your doggy though. It's like, hey, I'm going to replace you with your nephew or whatever because you were so special. I just want to replicate you. Isn't that gross? Like, I just want to celebrate every dog and their life and their path and where they came from. It's so much more interesting.
Two things. One, I want to say that this conversation in and of itself is bringing me to have a new thought. Okay, Sophie, just like you had one last night, I'm having one now in lifetime with you because of you. So thank you for that, which is that it is unfair for me to say that everybody who buys a dog wants a status upgrade. You are right. It could be. I never thought about it as, oh, this is a safety for me. This is security for me. This feels good. This feels like a known entity. I know what this will look like, feel like, and the fallout will be.
Also, if your neighbor, your sister, whatever bought from that breeder, you're like, oh, there, because her dog is healthy, mine will be. And there's this fallacy to think breeders cross their T's, you know, check the checklist and make sure everything is good. Breeders, okay, there's a small percentage of breeder that I can respect. Most breeders are so horrifically unethical, even when they think they are ethical. It takes 5 minutes to scratch the surface a little bit and you realize, oh, there's a litany of horrible shit that you're doing.
If you're putting a puppy in a crate on a plane and sending it somewhere sight unseen, I would say that's a red flag.
Yeah. If you're forcing a dog to breed when she doesn't want it or the male doesn't want it, or if it's a little traumatic, not ethical. If you have to cut any part of your dog, not ethical. If you have to do C-section for your dog, not ethical. And I don't know how many of you listeners know that, but bulldogs, French bulldogs,
English bulldogs,
and English bulldogs, Frenchies, and Boston Terriers, pugs, I'm not sure about the percentage, but these breeds, the flat face breed, the Brachy dogs, most of them, over 90% of them usually, need to have C-section. These dogs are not naturally constructed and fit to actually have puppies. I'm reading an awesome book, and I should remember the name of the author. I'm so sorry. I'll send you the information. It's about the post-human dog. So what if humans disappeared today in a blink? What would the dogs of tomorrow look like? And over generation, how would they evolve without us? And one other thing that the scientists said is, you know, basically all these breeds will disappear immediately because they can't even procreate naturally. Mm-hmm. Like, imagine two English bulldogs having sex. Like, do you realize the amount of contraptions that you need for that?
No,
you need to hold
that.
Like, their bodies are just not built for it. So every time a breeder tells me, oh, I breed bulldogs or Frenchies, but I'm ethical. My dogs are happy, well taken care of. I'm like, there's no such thing. If the dog is not naturally meant to have puppies and it needs so much human intervention, not to mention the trauma of C-sections and all that. Can you tell I'm all riled up? I'm getting warm.
No, I mean,
I'm just so passionate about
this. This is a warm, heated topic. Animals are. I don't think people, and I think this podcast like is a welcome space for that. Look, there are people listening who have English bulldogs and love their Frenchies and go to breeders and we love your dog. We love your love for the dog, but that doesn't have to change. However, I did have a conversation recently with someone who said something about her current Labradoodle and how she's on the wait list with the breeder for another Labradoodle because her dog is old. And I said to myself, like, first of all, I really did say to myself, like, what the fuck is going on? But I did have the thought, like, okay, Katya, as if I were talking to someone from a different political party, engage in the conversation, try to understand. So I said, hey, blank, you know, I've fostered shelter dogs. And if you ever are looking for another one, totally willing to like identify a dog that could just, you know, is already potty trained and gets along with other dogs and kids and like can seamlessly come into your home. Like, I'm so happy to help you, maybe your second dog. And her answer was like, I know, I don't rescue. The dog's already being born anyway. So like, what does it matter?
I'm triggered.
I am too, because I was at a birthday party and I didn't want to be like, it's supply and demand. But I did want to be like, it's supply and demand.
It's basically, if there's no demand, there's no supply.
Right. And the thing that's at the root of all of it, underneath all of it, is this very, excuse my charged word here, ignorant assumption that every shelter dog has something wrong with them or did something bad to end up there.
Right.
What an absolute...
That's like, the first misconception that we need to debunk. And
it is.
I try,
And it lies at the bottom of everything. It's even what you said about growing up in León, how, you know, it was like, oh, this idea, those are the old dogs. So those are the disregarded dogs. But you, Sophie, growing up as an animal lover with this deep heart, open heart for animals, you already got it, right? Of course you were going to end up in Puerto Rico. I'm sure you were already taking pictures, but of course you were going to be taken to photographing animals. And you went right to the ones that really nobody looks at. And then you were able to find a way to make people look. And I don't know how that happened. I don't know if you were consciously trying to make that happen or if you followed your heart and you're an artist, you followed your passion and it happened. But Pitbull Flower Power is about elevating the dogs that we're not looking at, making us see them, making them look beautiful and debunking the myth that something is wrong with them in the first place, other than the fact that they don't have an address. And I'm really riveted by how you started that sort of movement, because it's become a movement, and how all these thoughts you have are part of it. I feel this heat when I look at your work. Was there an animal? Is it each animal? How do you keep going when you know that dog in Puerto Rico that they brought in, that family, the dad lied and said, it's not our dog. And the kids said, and you know, that dog is going to get euthanized. How do you keep going despite all of that? How many times are you changed by an animal that make you keep going?
You know, animals always touched me. And I guess I always kind of felt bad for them and how little agency they had. Although back then I didn't have the words for it. But I remember, you know, going to the zoo and taking photos, and I would try to make the cages disappear. And like with my photos, I try to give a sense of freedom again. So to the tigers or, you know, giraffes or whatever. I also always felt like communicating with dogs in particular was much easier than humans. It felt like a more genuine understanding, like, okay, the dog doesn't like you, the dog likes you. You know, there's something more direct and simpler. I felt communicating with humans was always so difficult and you always misunderstood and words are used against you. Like, it was just really difficult. So with animals, it was easier. After I moved to New York from Europe, I just had a camera and I wasn't sure really what to do with my life. At that point, I had left a lot behind, my family, my job, you know, security, my apartment, everything. And I had a camera and I started taking photos in the street and just, you know, as a way to kind of get acquainted with my new life. And very soon, dogs became my safe place again. And I started pointing the lens towards them. And then I went to a vet clinic and I asked if I could take photos of the animals at the vet clinic while they were being manipulated, touched, and all that. Wow, and at first they were like, why do you want to take photos in our business? You know? And then quickly we became actually friends with the owners and I got to photograph surgeries. I got to just, I would just basically walk around the vet clinic in the back while they would do exams, surgeries, and things like this.
Journalist.
I just photograph anything I wanted. I mean, I think for Americans, that was pretty trusting.
Totally.
Everybody sues everybody here. I don't know. But so they actually really trusted me. And it was such a wonderful relationship. And that also opened a lot. Like I remember meeting my first dog who was like the owner was spending $20,000 on cancer treatment. And I was like, why would you pay for cancer treatment for a dog? Like I was still coming from my French mentality around animals. So it really shook a lot of things. It was very interesting. Very quickly, as soon as I heard about shelter dogs, which again was kind of a novel concept for me because I didn't really... And I lived in Switzerland before, between France and the US. And in Switzerland, there's no dogs, no shelter dogs. That's really not something...
They're just better. I get it.
I don't know, but definitely just not... Just not as many dogs too, you know, when you walk around and people just don't really have, maybe nowadays more, but back then I never saw dogs really. It was pretty rare. So they don't really need shelters.
Switzerland, who also stays out of all the wars, right? Switzerland. So the name of this episode is May We Be Switzerland. Life goals.
A friend of mine calls me Switzerland sometimes because I always try to see both sides of the story.
There you go. Be our Switzerland, Sophie.
I don't know. Now I think it's an insult because
it's
have to stand up for things. You know what I mean? Like it's good to see both sides of the story, but you can't be neutral.
Yeah.
Neutral is cowardly a little bit. But
so
just
maybe
to go
the
back,
episode is called Don't Be Switzerland?
I don't know. It's scary. Like Switzerland is comfortable. Whenever I voice something on social media that's a little strong, I open like, the gates
it's
of
scary.
Hell. And I think it takes a particular type of personality. You interviewed Rebecca Corey and like she's the kind of person that's just going to open wonderful. The gate of hell and be like, burn me, motherfuckers.
You know? I know. She makes you laugh. Which is so unfair.
She's
like,
so there's room for
amazing.
Everybody.
She's
but
amazing.
I don't think that's me. Yeah, I'm not an activist. I'm an advocate. And I think that's where the difference is for me. I like to bring difficult conversations to the table. So when I first heard about shelter dogs, the shelter system in the US, I was like, wow, I mean, I need to help. I need to be a part of this. I had a lot of time in my hands. Like I was figuring things out. So I figured I'm going to just donate my time to shelters, take photos, see what happens. Like I said earlier, it was difficult. A lot of doors were closed in my face. Finally, I found a rescue and then it kind of slowly snowballed from there. I spent about 2 years working with the Puerto Rico rescue. So most of my images were actually dogs in the street, stray dogs. And after a couple of years, I was kind of burned out for a lot of different reasons. But also because most of these dogs never really made it or were never really rescued.
Yeah.
Some of them were, of course, and I have like the full happy stories, but my computers was full of photos that I'm like, what's the point of these images? And like, what am I trying to do here? So I needed the win. I needed to feel like my images were really a catalyst for something positive. And so working in shelters felt, you know, I can set up a studio, I can photograph 40 dogs in one day and then quickly retouch them and then they can be used on the website, social media, and maybe accelerate the adoption process. Of course, back then, I mean, my photos would get 1-2 likes, like nobody knew me. Like I started from ground zero and then up. It was a slow, long, painful process of, am I ever going to make any difference? Is anyone ever going to care? And then a couple of years in, it was, am I going to be able to make a living at some point? Because I am broke. Like,
so you're voicing,
is fun, but...
You're voicing my current state. Thank you. Please go on and read my diary out loud.
I was broke. I was burnt out emotionally from a lot of the rescue stuff I was doing. And then I had a lot of photos. And I'm like, these photos are just not, you know, they're not going anywhere. And they might maybe one day help shelter dogs get adopted, but right now it's not paying the bills and it's not making a difference. It was pretty dark time. So I basically made a contract with myself. I had ideas of series I wanted to shoot. And because I was so busy with the rescue work, it was a 24/7, you know, job, of course.
It is.
I never really had the energy for it. So I thought, I'm going to quit my volunteer position and I'm going to give myself 2 weeks of just photographing all the series, the images I've had in mind for so long, and no more excuses, no more bullshit. I just stuck with it and I did it. And in one day, I photographed Wet Dog. And then I went back to France and I was broke and I was like, I'm using my last money to go visit my parents, basically. And I was like, so like, yeah, there was no light at the end of the tunnel. It felt really, really depressing. And I showed my photos to my father, who used to be in advertising and just like a good, like the equivalent of a creative director, I guess. I really trust his eye, like, or trusted. Now I think I surpassed the master, but back then I really deferred to his opinion. So I showed him my work. He flipped through some images and then he stopped at Wet Dog and he was like, this, what is this? I'm like, oh, Wet Dog, you know, just like a few images I shot in one day at the groomer in New York. He said, this is going to make you a career, or I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm like, oh, what do you mean make my career? What career? He's like, just send them to everybody you know. I'm like, I don't know anybody. He's like, well, just find someone. Just send them. I'm like, okay. I went back to New York and I'm like, who could I send these photos to? I didn't even have a website. I did not have social media. I was completely like, ugh.
This was and like, I, what, 5 years, 7 years
was,
ago?
That was 2013. Yeah. And I just sat with those images and I'm like, what am I going to do? And also I took a hard, cold look at myself and I realized I've never taken a chance, really. I've never submitted my work. I've never really put myself out there. And maybe it's time to put my big girl's panties on and do something. So I took my Wet Dog photos and I sent them to a couple of like art photography blogs. And to the both of them, immediately within an hour, I was like, we love this. We're going to publish now. And we're like, oh, wow, really? And yeah. From there, it went bananas. Bananas. I went viral like crazy. I won awards. I got a book deal. Like for the next few months, my life was insane. What it did is really kind of comfort me in my journey and tell me, you're onto something here. Don't give up just yet, but you're going to have to be brave. You're going to have to take chances. You're going to have to honor your work. It's not enough to take photos and let them sit in your computer. You have to take photos and then you have to put them in the world and you have to carry them and see every project through. And so because I got a book deal, I had to do a lot of Wet Dog photos for, you know, a few months. And I was so tired of studio work, Wet Dog, retouching, building the book. I was really tired of that process. And I wanted to glue things together and build stuff. Yeah. And so I decided I'm going to do a fine art series. And I wanted it to be for pit bulls in shelters in particular. People always ask me why. And the short answer is because I was afraid of pit bulls. Mm. And it just felt at the shelter, each time they would bring a pit bull, I would tense up and just be like, ugh, get the thing away from me. You know, I just didn't want
to
engage.
It's important to be honest. Yeah. It's important to be honest about that.
Yeah. It didn't feel... So it was weird because in France, I grew up with the same prejudice. Pit bulls are dangerous. They will eat your baby. They fight. They're for thugs, you know, and at the shelter, I would see the shelter staff and I trusted them. And they would bring a pit bull and say, oh, this one is so sweet. And like, she loves kids. She loves. And I'm like, I was having cognitive dissonance.
Yep.
Of wait. So, but they're monsters. Like they're so dangerous. You can't trust them. They're vicious. And then on the other hand, I would see these loving dogs and the shelter staff would tell me, no. I promise you, these dogs are just normal. Like they love, they want to be loved just like other dogs. And so because of that cognitive dissonance, I was like, you know what? I'm going to trust them. They're the professionals. I'm going to defer to them and I'm going to trust them. And I'm going to create a project about pit bulls that's going to force me to touch pit bulls, to be intimate with them, to seek the beauty in that dog. And not just the beauty. I could see the beauty, but I guess the safety. And the safety, you see it in the eyes. You know, you see it in a body language.
It's such a classic thing to put these flowers. It's so classic. It's so... reminds me of like a 1920s movie star, you know, it just feels very Greta Garbo. That's not 1920s, but I don't know when she was.
Yeah. I wanted them to look vintage originally.
It's like timeless. Those images, when they come up in my mind, when I see your work, they're people from an old timey glamorous world that has lived through some shit and is here because they've survived and is rich and deep and graceful and regal because of all of that. And so it's like, how did this match happen? And then I look and I'm like, there's no other match. Like she just felt into it. But I keep having this idea in my mind, Sophie, of you like wanting to find your place and getting behind the camera and pointing it at all these dogs, the dogs in Puerto Rico, the dogs in New York, the wet dogs and the pit bulls. And like, it's such a same of you behind the camera and what they're experiencing looking out at the world. Because when you're behind that camera, like you're them and they're you. It's just so remarkable. I keep seeing that in my mind as you're talking. I'm like, oh my God, she was photographing something for her, but for everybody, because she was them and they were her.
Yeah, it actually gives me the chill the way you phrased it, because it took me, you know, years of this journey and also some therapy, you know, to realize, yeah, I think I was their voice, but also because I can so relate to them in so many ways. And shelter dogs are in a moment of transition. You know, sometimes they left a beautiful life behind. Sometimes it was horrible. Like we don't know a lot of the time, but a lot of these dogs were loved and cared for. Like it's not just horror stories, right? So these dogs are transitioning from everything they knew, whether it was good or bad, into the unknown. And like what a privilege it is for us to witness it, to carry them through it, and to adopt them, to give them homes. Like that's why the breeder will never be an option for me. I mean, I should never say never, because who knows what the future, you know, will bring my way. I said I would never move across country for a man, and here I am. So you just never know. But
he's setting up your audio. When you and I were emailing, you were like, I don't have one dog that changed me. They all changed me. And I'm wondering if you still feel that, or if that's another thought that has been challenged in your nightly reflections.
You know, it's like if I asked you, is there a friend, you know, from your past that has changed everything for you? Like it would be very hard to pinpoint, because everybody brings something to the table. Like there's so many different ways of being impacted.
Yes.
I think with dogs, there's so many of them. Of course, I photographed thousands of them by now. So I would say the first pit bull flower power model, her name was Baby. That was impactful because at that point, I really did not know if my idea was going to work.
Did you make the crown?
Yes, I make the flower crowns. So my first shoot, I basically made like 20, 25 crowns. I had no idea. I had to buy a glue gun. I had to like figure out like, how do you even do this? Like, so I just kind of tried and made a few crowns. And then I found a shelter in Brooklyn that I knew had a lot of pit bulls, and a friend of mine she volunteered as a walker for them. So she facilitated the introduction. The person in charge there was a girl, a firecracker girl. And she was like, yeah, come, we'll help you. And I came with a suitcase of flower crowns. And I arrived there and I was still kind of new to like taking photos in shelters and also using the gear. Like I'm not a gear person. I'm not a photographer. I feel like I'm more an artist. Photography is one of my tools. Yeah. So I don't understand the techniques. I don't understand lenses. Whenever people want to interview me about this, I'm like, forget about it. Find another photographer, because I have zero answers to give. I understand nothing.
You remind me of my grandmother. When she would cook, we'd give her like a recipe and she'd be like, okay, I feel like salt, or I feel like sugar. I'm like,
it just make it happen.
It's in your stomach, but it's in your gut, but it's not on the paper that we're looking at.
Right. So I'm that girl. I just can't, don't give me a manual ever, because I won't read it. And I just can't be bothered with techniques. So photography. So back then, like I wasn't even sure how to set up light and like everything was kind of new. And here I am with my suitcase full of flower crowns. And then they're like, okay, so how do you want to do this? I'm like, I have no idea. And then I open my suitcase. Like, I'm like, I brought flower crowns for the pit bulls. I was hoping I could try this idea I have. All the volunteers and the staff there beside the main girl in charge, they were all like this big Brooklyn guy with like tattoos and chains and like super, you know, like urban Brooklyn guy. And they look at my flower crown and they were like, what is this? Like,
they're looking at it now. I know.
I was like, you know, I don't know. Let's just try. I don't even know if this is going to work, but let's try. And they were like, okay, great. Who do you want to see? What dog? I'm like, I have no idea. Like, just bring a dog who you think is going to be amenable to this, and we'll go from there. They were like, oh, we have the perfect dog, Baby. She's been here for months and we don't understand why. She's the sweetest, but she's a darker brindle and she's a little shy in her cage. So people just walk past her all the time. I was like, you know, she sounds like she will be perfect for this. And then they brought her and she was so scared. She's like, you know, unsure, like coming out of her kennel. Also, you know, the kennel was in the back and they opened the door and it's like, rah, 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 rah. Everybody's barking and it's nuts. So loud. And then they bring her out and she like quickly, you know, walks through the door and then they slam the door behind her and suddenly it's quiet. And it's just her like kind of looking around like, what is happening? Yeah. And I'm here and I'm looking around. I'm like, oh my God, there's a pit bull right here. You know, and I'm still nervous. And both of us, we were so nervous in that moment. And I grabbed the crown and the guy was like, yeah, just put your crown on her. I'm like, oh my God. I realized in that moment, I have to put the crown on that dog. A pit bull I've never met in my life. And we're going to have to be like a few inches from each other, face to face. That was a defining moment for the project because I was shaking and my hands were sweaty. I'm like, this is the dumbest idea I've ever had. And I take the crown and I wrap it around baby's face. Quickly, I go back to my camera and I think I'm going to look back and the crown will be on the floor. Baby would have shaken it off, like all of that. And I look up and baby is just sitting there looking at me. And she still has like, she has this big caramel, like sweet, inquisitive eyes of like, why am I here? And why is this my life? I'm sorry. It's actually making me emotional to think like, about it.
I want her in my arms.
She was, yeah. And the crown was there. And like, she was so poised and so elegant and trusting. And I was like, you know what? You trust me. I'm going to trust you. Let's just do this and see what happens. And that first photo actually is her portrait. Like it took one shot. And then the images, I figured I'm going to do like 5-6 portraits like this, post them on social media, give them to the shelter and then see if it helps the adoption. And then I'll move on with my life. The contract is done. I've helped a couple of pit bulls. I can move on with my life. The shelter shared the photos. And again, it went bananas, like viral. And if I thought Red Dog went viral, I was not prepared for pit bull flower power. It went absolutely nuts. Nuts. For like 2 years, it never stopped going viral and viral and viral. And, you know, celebrities reposting or like a blog would pick it up and then it would go again. And it was like wave after wave after wave. And the shelter started getting calls like, I want to meet the flower dogs, you know, and immediately was recognized as some kind of like movement. And everybody was asking me, so are pit bulls dangerous? Give us the answer. Yes or no? And I'm like, I have no idea. I literally just started this and I became propelled into this role of pit bull advocate. And I became like kind of my portraits became the image for the whole debate around pit bulls. The haters
It's important, I think, to just call out that you started this afraid of them. And I'm so happy that you don't try to shirk that truth because it's a place that people can relate to you from. And it's the point where everybody is invited in to say like, oh, maybe, oh, so she gets it. Now let me listen more. Oh, right. I had that thought. Let me lean in. Like it's so awesome that your fear, that you challenged your own fear and that it led you to something that could ultimately and does ultimately help a lot of people challenge their fears because of like, it started about you, but it became about everybody else. One of my writing teachers, Bruce Gelfand. He's a wonderful writing teacher in Los Angeles. He always says that it should start about you and become about everybody else. And
right. And
you did that. You did that with your art and you do that for those dogs. It's so beautiful. I love the story of Baby. Will you please, Sophie, tell us about how we can follow you and support you? Patreon's important because you do this all pro bono just for the love of these dogs and just to help them get adopted, which is remarkable and to spread the word.
And also, you know, when you say I do it all for the dogs, it's true, but it's also I do it because I'm an artist, you know, and I'm driven by putting my work in the world. I think sometimes people see me as an animal advocate first, but I see myself as an artist first. So I like these two. So it's not like, you know, I do sell prints, I sell books, calendars, and all that fuels my work. And then in return, I'm able to do pro bono work with shelters.
And both can exist. You don't, you know, I think, especially for women, it's important to call that out. We don't have to be selfless, absolute charitable angels with no needs, goals, or money. It's like, no, I also want a business. I'm also an artist and I'm creating something that I'm
proud of. It's tough. Yeah, it's tough to please all the part of your life. So the best way to support my work is to check it out first. If you don't know my work on social media, it's everything is at Sophie Gamond or Gamond. I have a website, of course. You can push that like button, you know, help adopt a dog or share a dog if you feel so compelled. You can follow my Patreon, become a monthly sponsor. So the Patreon makes me like, oh, sweaty a little bit because I feel icky asking for that kind of support. But it's also been so wonderful to have people who basically every month donate to my Patreon. And that allows me to never completely worry about, oh, I need to, you know, get a gig somewhere. I need to make money. So therefore, I'm not going to have time to do this other thing, like visiting a shelter. Or, so it's like, it's just so beautiful to have people support you in that way and lift yes. you up. And then I sell merch because people love the work. And I love to see my images on calendars, books, and cards. And it's just such a fun way to see. Oh, and this little hoodie that I'm wearing too. That's also one of my photos.
That little tongue. There's,
yeah, it's, yeah.
What am I supposed that's Walter. To do? Look away? Yeah, I can't.
It's part of the creative process too, like to see my images in the world like this. I kind of like sure. it. So yeah, that's a great way to support as well. Like just, you know, go to my store and buy something. And yeah, I'm hoping to fuel more projects. People Flower Power has been... It's been 7 years now. I've done about 450 portraits in the series. Even since the book came out, I have so many new stories and I'm dying to make another book, but that book nearly killed me. It was a lot.
I can't wait for you to do another book, but maybe in the meantime, you will come back and you will share more stories with us.
Yeah, yeah. I would love to. I have so many stories. It's these dogs are so, so special. And it's such an enriching career or work that I'm doing. And I started a new project with the dog meat survivors from South Korea with Humane Society International. So I have something coming up, hopefully this year. It's keep being pushed because of COVID, but soon in April, we were scheduled to release. And that's a series that is really fun. It's a series of portraits. It's kind of in the vein of Flower Power, but with a twist. And I cannot wait to share these portraits because I've been working on them for 2 years now during the pandemic. And it's time. I want them to go and live their best life.
I can't wait to see it. We can't wait to see it. And I love your excitement and your passion for your work and for the animals, both. I'm grateful to be in connection with you and to be on this same fighting squad with you. So
thank you.
Thank you for coming on this podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. I know there's so much more that you and I need to have like a separate private Zoom. Sorry, listeners, you're not invited to that one because it's going to be hours long. But I would love to connect in real life. I think we have a lot more that we can. It's all interesting to kind of challenge our thoughts and with other people that are like-minded, but also have different takes on some subjects because you do need to explore.
Yeah.
You can't just be stuck in one thought process. So I love that. Thank you so much for inviting me. And this was really fun.
Thanks for tuning in to The Animal That Changed You, a weekly podcast that features extraordinary people talking about the extraordinary animal that changed their life. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review. Follow us on Instagram at The Animal That Changed You and tell your friends. If you've got a story about an animal that's changed your life, DM me, tell me about it, or tag us. We would love to hear. We appreciate you. And honestly, we love your animals so much. Thanks for being here.
Hi. For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IRoarPod.com.